I was looking at that statue on the altar. It's a different one, huh? It's not the same one that we...
I think it's an excellent one, yeah.
Huh? Yeah. And where does it come from?
It was a statue from Margarita.
Uh-huh.
But it was broken and it was not well, and Tiago, he started for the suture.
So it's the same statue, but it's been restored.
It's been restored.
Yeah. And it has one of the hands in the position pointing to the ground, which is one of the classic positions of the Buddha statues. And it indicates it's pointing to the ground. And that is a reference to when the man who we call the Buddha returned to find his comrades who he had left in the forest and to go off on his own searching. And they had what we call his awakening. He went back to his friends. And they could see something was changed. But they said to him, what is the proof of your awakening? And he pointed to the ground and he said, the earth, the solid, healthy earth, is my witness. And this represents that.
The earth is my witness within me?
Voilà. La terre témoigne mon éveil. And this goes exactly to the heart of the practice. We think that the practice is about the sky, about being somewhere else, some altered, transcendent state, something different than just this earth. And the earth symbolizes, in the Buddha's statement, but in general when I'm talking, ordinary mind, ordinary life. Things as they are. He didn't say sky. Although we say that his awakening came when he saw the morning star arise in the sky after a long, torturous night of struggle, of fighting with his inner demons, which we all know very well. He had been fighting with those demons for a long time. It wasn't just that night. But that night was when it came to a head. And in the morning, he looked up, and there was the star. So we could have thought he would say to his friends, the morning star is my witness. But he was sitting on the earth. He was here, right here, now. He wasn't somewhere else. This is what he realized. In that moment, he also realized, and this, it's been recorded, this is what he said. Of course, no one was there. So no one was there but him. So we don't know what he said. But someone said, this is what he said. And when they said that, whoever wrote that the first time, or transmitted that for the first time, they knew for themselves what his experience had been. And so they could say, this is what he said. Or maybe he said, this is what he said. He said, and it's written not on this Rakasu that I have, but on the other one, How wonderful. All beings have the virtue and understanding, the realization of the Tathagata, which is a name for himself. Simultaneously. This is proof of his realization of the oneness, that there is no just me alone realizing something. We are all together. He realized at once this here, right now, himself, on the ground, and all others, everyone, because all is one. So he realized the oneness and the diversity, or the unity and the difference, let's say. There is not one without the other. It's impossible to see the unity without seeing the diversity. In order to see each person, I have to see their uniqueness. And in order to see their uniqueness, I have to see our oneness, that we are not separate. Otherwise, I can't see that they are unique. Otherwise, I see what my projection is of them. So this initial pointing to the ground, the earth is my witness. Is the basis, the essential aspect of this practice. And there's the very funny story of, I don't know if I've told it here, but of the Arab wise man fool, Nasruddin. Has anyone heard of him? No? Mm-hmm. Maybe I haven't told this story here. Okay. It was someone here, it was Hui who first told me this story. Someone here in Portugal, Hui. Oh, actually, I don't know if he told me a Nasruddin story, not this one, I think. So he's this classic figure in Islamic literature and Arab, throughout the Arab world, he appears. From Turkey to, I don't know, probably Pakistan, beyond. All across Central Asia, in the Middle East. And he's a wise man, but he's a fool. He looks like a fool to the people who think they are wise men. And yet has a wisdom that they don't see. So at one point he's going back and forth across the border between two territories. I don't know where, Iraq and Iran, maybe something. Some lands that probably no longer exist, that have been destroyed by American bombs, but he's going back and forth once a month, once a week, and always with a donkey. And the guards at the border are sure that there's something weird going on. He's suspect. Nasruddin, they always suspect him of something not good, something tricky. But they can never figure it out. So this time they think that he must be smuggling something. Must be some sort of traffic going on. Money, jewels, food, who knows what, but something. And so they stop him, and they search him. They search the donkey. They go through all his bags, his pockets. Nothing. So he comes back again. Can't figure it out. So they search him again. Every time, the same routine. They look in the donkey's mouth. They look everywhere. Nothing. Goes on and on. Many years later, after one of the border guards has retired, he's an old man, and he's sitting having a coffee somewhere, a tea, smoking his pipe, and Nasreddin comes. And he says, "Nasreddin, sit down, I'll buy you a drink." They start talking, and he said, "Listen, I'm retired. I don't care anymore. Please tell me, what were you smuggling? I really want to know. I know it was something, but we just couldn't figure it out. Please tell us." So Nasreddin takes a while and has his drink and enjoys sitting there. And finally, the border guard insists, "Please tell us." Nasreddin says, "Okay, donkeys." It was right before their eyes.
They didn't see.
The most obvious thing, right there. The most concrete, the most clear, the biggest object that Nasreddin was bringing across the border. It is.
Le trafic d'âmes, c'est ça?
Oui. So, this is the story of our lives. It's us. The most obvious, direct, biggest, clearest, most intimate thing in our life. It's us. It's you. It's me. But what does that mean? Okay, so I tell you this, you understand the Nasreddin story. Okay, the donkey's clear. But what does that really mean? I always, at some point or another, mention what my name is that my teacher gave me, because it directly addresses this question. But it occurred to me as I was sitting here that two of the people who I have given names to have names that say the same thing as my name, just in a different way. And when we give these names, the people receive these names when they ask to, when they say, "Okay, I acknowledge that this is my way, this is my practice, and I acknowledge that I am the way. I am acknowledging the earth as my witness." Even though we don't necessarily get it so much, something in us says, "Okay, that's it." And so they make these little things, go through a ceremony, and I give them a name, which is a name that acknowledges what they are acknowledging. And it's their true name. Of course, they answer to the names of Sarah and Sophie and Amy. But these names touch the essence of who they are and are a constant question. What does this name mean? What do I do with this name? It's something we can't get our mind around. So, will you tell your names?
My name is Amour Partagé.
Maybe.
Say again the translation again, I've forgotten.
Amour partagé.
Yeah. And the translation?
Shared love.
Can you?
Blossom of Nirvana.
Blossom of?
Nirvana.
So now you might think, hearing these names, that these are impossible names that have something to do with the sky. But they absolutely are of the earth. Nirvana is not somewhere else. Nirvana is the heart of your life, right here. A blossom of Nirvana is right there. Amour partagé, shared love, is also a very concrete of the earth name. It reflects the truth of our being. There is nothing other than love, our being. And the only way to express it is to share it. And the only way to share it is to be it. And we have, this is how we be it, by being who we are, concretely. In every step we take, every breath, every action, someone else has the name Terre d'Éveil, which is the land of awakening, the earth of awakening. Same thing. He is that. He is the place of awakening. It can't be anywhere else. Here and now is the theater of awakening. It can't be anywhere else. Someone else has the name, it's Margarita, actually, who's not here, a Portuguese woman. Her name is Cœur Pur. She wanted a French name. She's Portuguese, but she wanted a French name. Pure heart. That also sounds like something transcendent, something pure. But the pure heart is the heart that holds everything. What we think of impure and what we think of pure. What we think of as sacred, what we think of as profane. The pure heart is the heart that holds it all. And it can only do that here, now, in our being as we are. My own name is Tu es cela. It's more sort of, you are that. It's very, nothing extra in there. And yet it's more abstract in a sense than the other names. So it's almost more difficult for me to grab onto. I have no blossom. I have no love. I have no earth, I have no heart. And yet it's all there. It's very concrete. It's the donkey. It's right there. So these names all point to this very concrete aspect of this practice, in which we are engaged, at least for the moment that we are sitting on the cushion. Right now, you're listening, you're engaged in it. When you stand up and walk, you're engaged in it. When you clean the toilet, you're engaged. When you do the shopping, you're engaged. When you brush your teeth, you're engaged. every moment. But most of the time, we are like the border guards, not seeing the donkey. We see that there's something going back and forth. And we have these, we're looking for something. And we're determined to find it. But we're looking in the wrong place. We're looking somewhere else. One of the great Zen stories, too, is a very simple one. I've talked about him before, I'm sure, the Buddha's cousin, who's called Ananda. And who I've told he accompanied the Buddha throughout his 40 years of teaching, ate with him, often slept in the same room, spent all his days with him, and yet was still looking for something. It was like the border guard still looking for something, what was being smuggled here. And the Buddha died. And Ananda continued, and he stayed with the Buddha's successor, Mahakashapa. And one day he said to him, "So, what did the Buddha give you? What is it that you got that I didn't?" He gave you a bowl, I know, which was the symbol of his teaching. And he gave you the robe, which was his robe. But what else is there? What did he give you that I don't have? What am I not getting? And Mahakashapa turned to him and he said, "Ananda?" And Ananda said, "Yes." And then there's a form that Mahakashapa said, which was, "Take down the flag from the temple." Apparently, when a talk like this was being given, or a teaching, the flag would go up, so that people in the neighborhood could see and come. If there was a flag flying, it meant they could come and hear the teaching. And when the talk was finished, the flag would be taken down. And so after Ananda asks him the question, and Mahakashapa says, "Ananda," and Ananda responds, "Yes," he says, "Take down the flag. The teaching has been given." At the same time, Ananda realized, got it. We say, got it. It's an idiomatic phrase, because he's not really getting something. So what did Ananda get? What happened? What happened in that very simple exchange?
He understood that you need to be him. Mm-hmm. So only that.
And what does that mean, to be him? And what does it mean, need? Maybe he recognized, maybe the need is not even necessary.
He doesn't need to see in others what he needs. Mm-hmm. He has inside of him. Mm-hmm.
And that's why at that moment we say the transmission was accomplished. And Ananda becomes the third successor, the second success. Mahakasha was the first. It sounds very simple, doesn't it? When we see these, we hear the stories, and it seems very clear. So what's our problem? What are we doing? Making it very complicated. Right. And maybe the complication is necessary. In fact, not maybe, it's because that's what we are. We're a complex organism, a human being. Which is at once provides, which gives us our marvelous beauty and our absolutely terrible side. The side that kills. We are the only species that kills each other. Right? Just for no reason. We think that we need to conquer the earth to solve our problems. We need to possess parts of it. We need to make it different than it is, tame it, to solve our problems. And yet, all we need to do is be in touch with it. Be it, the earth being us. So when we're sitting here on our cushions, or when we're eating together, when we're walking, cooking, listening, sleeping, whatever. We can come back to that. Remind ourselves, I'm walking on the earth. I'm sitting on the earth. What does that mean? What does it mean directly? Where am I looking instead of seeing the donkey? When I'm looking somewhere, I can think, what am I looking at? Question it. Knowing that the earth is your witness. Sometimes it's frightening to question because we feel there's no solid ground. There's nothing we can rely on. We'll go crazy. We'll have nothing. The earth is your witness. A constant reminder. Does anyone have questions or? Does that stir something up for you? Or
does it work?
Ça roule quelque chose? Stir something up? Speechless? That's the...
C'est to stir up?
Mm-hmm.
Stir up life.
Life. And how does life manifest?
Expanding.
Because when we, if we don't question, if we fix upon our ideas, our usual, if we stick to our original name, we become identified with it, right? And I'm using our name because I was talking about the other names, but I can say this name that we have represents this identity that we have. And so we're constantly looking for that identity, like the guards looking for something else apart from the donkey. And that identity is very limiting. So when we hear something else and it resonates, that frees us a bit from that standard identity that we have. And it opens the gates to this no one. This one who is no one. Who has another name, but that's no one. And this is the truth of our being. And that's where we can truly open to the others. When we're not struggling to protect our territory. We have nothing to gain or lose. And that's why it's expensive. Nasruddin was smuggling donkeys. Maybe it was the same donkey. Who knows?
Having nothing to gain or losing, what is purpose?
There isn't one. Not in the sense that we think, though. We think, oh, so there's no purpose. There's no meaning. This is our head that is thinking this. Our head, gain and loss are concepts and intellectual, they belong to our intellectual understanding. Right? When we truly have nothing to gain or lose, the question of meaning no longer presents itself. It's obvious. Just this. When we're thirsty, we drink water. When we're hungry, we eat. When we're tired, we sleep. Someone asks us for directions, we give them. Everything becomes a tool. Everything becomes what is. Everything becomes just as it is. Everything already is just as it is. We don't need a reason to help someone. We don't need a reason to drink the water. It doesn't have to have a purpose. As long as we are involved in the materialist approach to practice, to life, getting something, having a purpose, obtaining, arriving, loss and gain, we will keep winning and losing, which in fact is just another way of not getting anything, in fact. Because there's nothing to get. There's nowhere to go. Nowhere to go. Ananda is Ananda. The donkey is the donkey. Nasreddin is going back and forth across the border, but there is no border. He's not going or coming anywhere. And the guards are looking for something materialist, something and in fact this notion of no one, not having a personal attachment to me and not having anything to gain or lose, is what we can call the ultimate wealth attitude.
Ultimate wealth
attitude.
Attitude.
Or anti-poverty attitude. It's pointing to the abundance, the richness, the overflowing bounty of this moment. Every moment.
With the risk of speaking of futility, does it mean that if I am no one, I can receive so much larger what's going on? Because I'm not restricted to the one I think I am.
Mm-hmm.
So I can receive all.
And yet, ultimately, there is nothing to receive because I have everything already. I have nothing. I mean, now we're getting into the absolute point of view. On the concrete point of view, I am just this, Ananda. And each one is just who they are. And because we have experienced the absolute side of our being, we see that in the other as well. So we are at once no one and everyone. Which is just very briefly, as many of you know, I'm writing this text about James Joyce's hero, Bloom, and from Ulysses, and the Buddhist notion of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is one who has realized his true nature, and therefore sees the only thing to do is to help others realize that. In James Joyce's book, Bloom represents that. And it's just the whole story, the whole book, hundreds and hundreds of pages, is one day. The very ordinary life of this man. An ordinary man. And yet, he goes about his day manifesting the qualities of the Bodhisattva. He begins in the morning with the very kind to his cat, and then kindness to his wife, who is not so kind to him. And then helping someone, going to someone's funeral, and then visiting someone in the hospital, and then going about his usual work life. Just everyday life. Again, the earth is the witness. Just this. And at one point in the story, when he is being attacked by, bullied by a group in a pub, he finally stands up and says, "Hate is no way for men and women to live." And the crowd of guys hanging out in the pub say, "Huh, well, what is the way? Tell us then." And Bloom says, "Love." He has absolutely no purpose, no motive for that, except as a response to the situation at hand. And throughout his day, everything he does expresses that. From the moment he wakes up until the moment he goes to bed.